The first question I want to discuss with you for a moment this morning is whether Daniel in Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 and 20, and also Daniel in Ezekiel 28 and 3, is it? Whatever it is, one of the three. Is the Daniel the prophet of the exile? I said 28:1, I think, error. That was a slip. Whether that Daniel in Ezekiel, these three places, is the prophet of the exile and the prophet of the book of Daniel. The name is spelt differently in Ezekiel from it is in the book of Daniel. And the question of whether the name Daniel, found between Noah and Job in these places, that is in Ezekiel 14, 14 and 20, is that, as some of the scholars, some of the conservative scholars even suggest, that this Daniel is not Daniel the prophet, but another, a patriarch, another of the age of Noah and Job, of the name Daniel, known, we are told, only from the Ras Shamra tablets from the ancient city of Ugarit in northern Syria. I don't know if you'd be able to identify that. Well, it's not far from the turn of the eastern Mediterranean, near the top there. If you're looking at the map, the place is now called Latakia. That place, Ugarit, just a little south of Seleucia. And you can find that in your Bible map, which was the seaport for Syrian Antioch. That's where these tablets came from. Most people would think that Ezekiel putting Daniel between Noah and Job, two of the most ancient men in the Bible, excluded that Daniel was the same as the prophet Daniel, who was, of course, the exact contemporary of Ezekiel, and was carried away to Babylon, was Daniel, in the first deportation of the Jews in 605 B.C., 8 years before Ezekiel was taken in 597, when Ezekiel was taken along with young Jehoiakim. 8 years, then, between Daniel being taken and Ezekiel being taken. And here's Ezekiel writing about Daniel later on. But 8 years is long enough for the stripling prophet Daniel, very probably of the royal blood, certainly a noble of Judah, to have made his mark and his name with King Nebuchadnezzar. See, and you can consider this perhaps later on, Daniel chapters 1 and 2, which we read, and Daniel chapter 4. There isn't much help from the scholars here. They can't make up their minds whether this is Daniel or not, although some are pretty sure that it's not. Well, what do you think on the basis of those facts I've given you? On the whole, since nothing was heard of this ancient Daniel, the patriarch, until the Ras Shamra tablets were unearthed in northern Syria in 1930 A.D., only 48 years ago, we must surely assume that Ezekiel, mentioning him along with Noah and Job without further identification, is assuming that the Lord's people will know which Daniel is meant. And who else could that be but the great prophet of the exile? I'm not dogmatizing, I'm just saying what appears to me to be the more reasonable, since we're not helped very much. And of course we appreciate that scholars, if they don't know, say so. And if I don't know, say so, but it looks to me a little as if. Although it's curious that there he set this late prophet between these two ancient patriarchs. But of course, they are classified together in particular characteristics. It's their wisdom and their authority and their power, and that doesn't change. He could have classed a whole lot of men, could Ezekiel, all down the centuries, from Noah right on, Abraham, Moses, Joshua, David, Jeremiah. So that as far as the classification is concerned, I think that you could say that Daniel belongs, although to a very different age from these two. Certainly it can hardly be the Daniel in Ezekiel, can hardly be David's second son by Abigail, you remember, who is also called Kileab, who, that is 2 Samuel 3:3 and 1 Chronicles 3:1. This Daniel, also called Kileab, was assumed to have died young. There's no more word of him, although he's second son. And you see, the references in Ezekiel speak of Daniel, along with Noah and Job, as men of great wisdom and sagacity, who endured in evil days, although Daniel's experience in the lion's den, chapter 6, may have taken place later, probably not later than Ezekiel was writing. And certainly in the Old Testament sweep of the divine economy, the news, the intelligence that God gave to Daniel about the bright and glorious future of his people, the Jews, right to the end of the age, alone marks Daniel out as a very notable character, as great in later Old Testament ages in his way as Noah and Job, these great characters. Anyway, whatever you say about that, we have ample evidence of the rarity of Daniel's character, of his godly character, at the very beginning of the book of Daniel, when he and his three friends, when I was preparing this, I intended that we should read the first chapter of Daniel, and you'll see evidence of this in my script, but actually we read the second chapter. But you know what the first chapter is about, I think. Have a look and see if you're not very sure about the food and all that. I'm saying here, we have ample evidence of what a rare character Daniel was when he and his three friends, the same lads of the fiery furnace in chapter 3, refused the king's meat in his own palace, having been already singled out, even among the royal and noble captives from Jerusalem, as we see in chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, for special imperial service. These four, here they were, these Jewish lads, but very special Jewish lads, at the heart of the great and growing Babylonian Empire, singled out for special service to the emperor, no less. And they dared to be so alarmingly different from the others in Babylon that the king's chief eunuch feared not only for their heads, but for his head, as you see in that chapter. Mind you, thinking about that, the daring of the Jews, I have no doubt at all that the amazing boldness of the Israelis today, we hope and pray they won't be too bold this very day, or tomorrow, or the next day. That the amazing boldness of the Israelis in face of Russia and America and China, if necessary, and certainly the Arab world, is not merely a natural boldness. It's not always wise, but it's not merely a natural boldness, albeit sturdy independence has been ingrained in them for thousands of years. I believe their boldness is basically, even when it's misguided and misused, as it often is, alas, I believe it's part of God's gift to them. Don't say they are unbelievers. I know they are. Just now. But so was Cyrus, king of Persia. And see what God made him do. The Israelis won't always be unbelievers. Romans 11:26. What I really mean there is that don't let us exalt these godly men of past days. In this case, Daniel. As if they had something special about them naturally that we may not have in the Lord's will. Their speciality that we are concerned about is God-given, not natural. However gifted naturally they are and were, however famous historically these great men were, God has given to them great and wonderful natural gifts, which are seen even when they've turned against their God and their Christ. God hasn't withdrawn their gift. The genius of the nation is not withdrawn because they rejected Christ and crucified him. Notice that. But it's not their natural gift I'm talking about here. And it's not Daniel's natural gift of the royal blood, if that's the case. And all his natural gifts, perhaps his beauty and all the rest of it, handsomeness. Because in this that we are thinking of this morning, as far as Daniel's concerned, it's God that we're going to glorify. And it's God that we must glorify in Daniel, as in anyone else that the Lord chooses to use and bless, then or now. Now, that doesn't mean that we dismiss the Lord's servants because it is God that we glorify. That doesn't mean that we despise them. It doesn't mean that we belittle them. There used to be someone around here who, whenever anything commendatory, kind and nice was said about the Lord's work at Gilcomston, instantly used to break in and say, "Of course it's not you, it's God." And I always used to think that, although that's perfectly true, where anything's done at all, it's done by God, no one else can work but God. I always used to think that, true as that is, that was said as a kind of a slap in the face. You don't slam the Lord's servants, whoever they are, because it is all of the Lord, but should remember that there is a cost to them also to be what we may call the conductors of his power. Think of that for a moment, conductors of his power. Why do old houses need to be rewired for electricity? Because conductors of power become worn. Virtue, if you like to put it this way, goes out of them. In the very act of giving all the glory to God, it is possible to be gracious to the Lord's servants. And in case you think I'm thinking of me, I'm not. I'm thinking of you, particularly the office bearers and others of the Lord's servants here. In some congregations we hear from time to time the office bearers in the church, the elders, and I suppose more so the deacons, are regarded as being second class to the minister. What a deplorable and horrid and wrong thought. We're all serving the Lord together. Our obligation is to be grateful to one another in honor preferring one another. God give us grace more and more here to get the right, the biblical and the true balance as far as that is concerned. You all know, I think, that we are deeply concerned that we should find that right balance, whatever it is. Nonetheless, it's God's power in Daniel that we are magnifying here today. And God saw to it that the four boys of chapter 1 were in better condition without the king's fancy food when the test came. As indeed Daniel said they would, and as he believed they would be in better condition than those who took the king's food. But that even if not, like his three friends, under the threat of the fiery furnace, God didn't bless as they hoped, he would still have refused to budge on his principles. Because on every level, these laws or principles of Daniel were nothing short of life to him. They were absolutely everything to Daniel, his principles, the rule of God, the word of God to him, by which he lived. It was everything to him, from mere survival to his health and his wealth and his prosperity. As well as they were everything to him for the survival and the welfare of his people, the Lord's people, the Jews. After all, God promised life to Israel if she would keep his law. But we know that she did not, and nearly died, until God at last had mercy on her. That's the first chapter then. Then in Daniel chapter 2 that we read, Nebuchadnezzar is troubled with his dreams from his second year. Notice this, troubled with his dreams from his second year. Which reminds us of King Saul, how soon he got high-minded. 1 Samuel chapters 14 and 15. Oh, the danger. How men change when they are given power. How power goes to men's heads. Talk about corrupting. And how we should pray for those who are lifted up from amongst the people and given power and authority and influence. How we should pray for such as President Carter and Premier Callaghan and Sadat and Begin and Brezhnev and Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum in China. That they may not become so big-headed. And often big-headed becomes pig-headed, doesn't it? As to engineer their own destruction and that of their peoples. So in chapter 2, all the wise men of Babylon were sought to help Nebuchadnezzar interpret and tell, in fact, let alone interpret his dream. Did you ever meet such a perverse fellow in all your life? And since those sought to tell the dream and interpret couldn't be found, Nebuchadnezzar, as we know, in a fury, would have all the wise men of Babylon slain, including the untried Daniel and his friends. Wait a moment, says Daniel to the captain of the king's guard. We haven't been tried yet. Give us a shot. Tell the king that we haven't been tried in this matter of dreams and interpretation. And the king saw reason. Well, God saw to that. Yes, he's sovereign, you know, is our God. Bless him, he's sovereign. So Daniel got his chance. So he said to Neb, if I may shorten it, in speaking as I have done in writing, he said to Neb, no, I can't tell your dream, but our God can and he will. Well, daring faith. Hebrews 11 and 1, daring faith. How sure this fellow was of his God. Not of himself, but of his God. But then, should he not have been sure of his God? Are you not sure of your God? Are you not sure? How sure are you? How sure are you to declare his truth with confidence? Why not? Why, not in all the world be sure about our God. Daniel is sure of his God who made him of the stock of the Jews, through whom God himself was to come one day in the flesh. Was not the same human blood running through Daniel's veins as would run through Jesus' veins one day? So he said, "Oh, yes, my God will tell you your dream." And he did. He's always as good as his word, our God. All that he speaks, all that he spoke to his Son and the Spirit in eternity before any of us was, he will do. Every word he will do. But what I want you to think of at the moment here in chapter 2 is, fancy God giving to that pagan world emperor. Credit this. God gave to that pagan world emperor a prophetic view of history. The thing that you would think God would only have given to the godly. A prophetic view of history stretching through nearly 600 years to the coming of Christ. It seems incredible. Lord, you do daring things. The things you do take our breath away. Selecting the most astonishing characters from anywhere. How conservative and narrow-minded we are in our selections, aren't we? How we dismiss and refuse sometimes angels unawares because we've got our own silly, narrow, parochial, conservative views of who is and who is not and who will be and who will not be. We should see every sinner as a potential saint. We don't know who God has. We don't know in Aberdeen who God has yet. We're talking about trophies of grace. Do you really believe that? I'd never prayed like that before. I hope you took that in, and I hope you're going to do it. I am. I've got a new idea from that. Do we see every sinner? No, we don't. We've been rebuked once or twice in the prayer meeting by youngsters correcting us when we've deplored somebody who's against the Lord's work. Of course we deplore it, but dismiss them? God can snatch them out of Satan's hand. All right then. God gives to this world emperor, in a dream admittedly, a view of history to come for hundreds of years. But then, on the collapse of Israel, God's world power, God appointed Nebuchadnezzar to take the place of David's royal line. We read that, and I drew your attention to it in Daniel 2, verses 36 and 37. With the coming of Israel to the land and the ascendancy of David and Solomon, God set that nation of Israel on high as the nation in the world. But then they sinned so grievously for hundreds of years that God dismissed them. He demoted them. He said, "Down! Out!" And so he raised God using Satan as his instrument, as his agent, raised a whole series of empires: Assyria, Babylon, the Medes, the Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans, to thrash his people and subdue them and bring them to their senses for their sins. So this is the second one. This is not said so plainly of Assyria, but surely said plainly of Nebuchadnezzar. So we can understand why God had given such intelligence, such prophetic knowledge to this pagan emperor. But Nebuchadnezzar, of course, couldn't understand that intelligence. He couldn't understand the dream without God's man. Rather like the Ethiopian eunuch, you remember, in his chariot, needed Philip to interpret Isaiah chapter 53 for him so that he might be saved. Oh yes, the word needs interpreters. Very much, very much. But once the Lord plants his word, whether it is by dream or any other means, in the heart of a man, it burns. You see, that dream, and Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed before, don't you think? Was that the first dream that Nebuchadnezzar had ever dreamt? Not in your life. He had dreamt before, but this one was burning in his mind and in his heart and his bones. God's word was in it. He couldn't understand that, but he knew that something was burning within him. Of course he did. And so he had to find Daniel. God found Daniel for him to make known what it was. Now, let me give you a little bit of interpretation here. You may not all agree with it, but I think if you studied it long enough, you might. The four successive empires gathered together under the image in chapter 2. We're not going to go into all this prophetic business very much, because it's Daniel as a man we're concerned with, but let me just say in passing, the four successive empires, you know, the image of the gold and the silver and the bronze and so on. The four successive empires gathered under the image are said by Orthodox scholars to be Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Compare E.J. Young's commentary and many other places. But recently, a medical doctor, Robert Gurney, working with Muslims in northern Kenya, whose brother of the Red Sea Mission team was here visiting us a year or two ago. The Gurneys belong to an heroic American missionary family. I don't know if Rob and Florence know of them, but they're quite well known in certain missionary circles. Well, Robert Gurney, a doctor like the doctor who was here, after many years studying Daniel and daring to pit his scholarship with the best minds, certainly in this country and beyond, I think, too, he says, no, these four empires are not, as you say. They are not Babylon, Medo-Persia, taken together, Greece and Rome. Since the remnants of the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great lasted right through until B.C. 27, when Egypt became a Roman province. So you run, he says, you run right through from Alexander the Great and his demise in, what was it, 323. Right to that time, a handful of years before Christ came. Not that the Romans weren't appearing then, of course. But the significance of that empire, he suggests, runs right through. Well, the language, the Greek language, for one thing. So he says the empires, these four empires are Babylon, Media, Persia, and he separates these two and justifies it. I can show you what he says if you like. Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece. And Dr. Gurney asserts this also of Daniel chapter 7 and of Daniel chapter 11, if you know your Daniel very well. Rome only coming in toward the very end of Daniel chapter 11. Anyway, that's for another day. That's all you're getting of that. Although I recall that I did a midweek Bible study on this last April. You all remember, I'm sure. However, Daniel gave Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of his dream, and Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face before Daniel and made him next to himself in the province of Babylon, center of a great world empire. Then, of course, Daniel sought promotion for his three friends. Then we come in chapter 3 to the burning fiery furnace. And so Nebuchadnezzar saw, notice this as we sweep through now quickly, Nebuchadnezzar saw more of the wonders of the God of the Jews, but he didn't change his ways. He was too powerful a monarch to do that, except by divine power and judgment. Nebuchadnezzar continued to strut as proudly as ever. Is not this great Babylon which I have built by my mighty power, says he? Whereas the truth was that it was all by God's power. See those verses again, 2:37, that I'm referring to. God's power, not his. But he didn't know that, the proud fellow. And of course, as we know, Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation came far more swiftly than Herod's did later. You remember? Herod in the theater at Caesarea, not so very far north from what happened yesterday near Tel Aviv. Herod in the theater at Caesarea, a place that I've stood in with Tom Swanson. The theater practically intact by the sea there. Herod sat on his throne in the theater, dressed in a shimmering garment, glistening in the sun. And the people shouted that he was a god, Acts 12:23, if you want the passage. The people shouted that he was a god, I suppose after the Roman I Claudius manner. And he was smitten, there and then it appears, and was eaten by worms and died. Well, God isn't quite as hard on this man whom he's appointed to be world emperor, but Nebuchadnezzar's reason left him after that, and he went into the garden and crawled like a beast, and his nails became like birds' claws, you remember the story, and his hair like eagle's feathers, until his reason returned to him with humility. All in the mercy of God. All this Nebuchadnezzar dreamed beforehand and sought Daniel to interpret, which, of course, Daniel did, greatly trembling. Fancy revealing to the king that was going to happen to him, that he was going to crawl on the ground like a beast and eat grass. But, of course, if God said it, Daniel would say it, whatever it meant. And so here's a third occasion in which Nebuchadnezzar saw. He wouldn't have known about the dietary ploy in chapter 1, I don't think. But here's the third occasion in which Nebuchadnezzar saw not only the wisdom of this Jewish stripling, Daniel, but saw his faith in the power of his God, so that Nebuchadnezzar was humbled as... Look at Daniel chapter 4 and read a verse or two. Daniel chapter 4. The beginning. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has wrought toward me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Look at verse 34 in the same chapter. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, what doest thou? Etc., etc. You see that? The rest of it's wonderful too. Ah. But you see, if I may say so reverently, the hero of it all is not Daniel interpreting, revealing and interpreting dreams to the king. The hero of it is the God of the Jews. The God of the Jews, thoroughly believed in by his servant Daniel. Next chapter, that's 4. Then we have another monarch, Belshazzar, and his pride. But chiefly his desecration of the holy vessels from the Lord's temple at Jerusalem. And the writing on the wall, and the fear of the queen mother. E.J. Young thinks she may have been Nebuchadnezzar's widow, who, hearing the commotion in the banqueting hall, came in as Belshazzar sank to his knees with fright at the writing on the wall. And she said to Belshazzar, "It's Daniel you need, you silly boy." And so Daniel interpreted. Chapter 5, verse 24. Meeny, meeny, tekel, parson. And what did that say? "You're finished, you clown. You're finished. Your kingdom is given to the Medes and Persians." And it was. For he died, says the last verse in that chapter. Look at it and see. He died that very night, 5:30. Next chapter, 6, tells us of Darius and the lion's den. Now, of course, after Nebuchadnezzar's experience with Daniel and Daniel's God, and Belshazzar's experience with Daniel and Daniel's God, Darius had more respect for Daniel and for Daniel's God. But nonetheless, he got himself into trouble because of the jealousy of the courtiers with respect to Daniel. A bit like Haman with Mordecai in Esther. You remember the story? Jews don't readily bow down and worship men, whoever they are. Whereas no threat on earth would prevent Daniel from saying his prayers and giving thanks to his God 3 times a day, morning, noon and night, whatever happened. The skies could fall, but he would still pray to his God, because his God was behind the skies, even if they fell. So Darius, tricked into signing the decree forbidding anyone to pray to any but himself for 30 days, had to consign Daniel to the lion's den. "Watch what you sign, Darius. Why didn't you read the small print of these wicked men's intentions? Sleepless night for Darius, and an early morning." Do you remember how King Ahasuerus, Xerxes, in the book of Esther, couldn't sleep and sent for state records for bedtime reading, and found that Mordecai, the Jew, that Haman, the Esauite, wanted to destroy with all the rest of the Jews because he wouldn't bow down to him. Mordecai had saved the king's life from a plot to destroy him. And so King Ahasuerus read in the records that no reward had been given to Mordecai. He hadn't even been commended. Well, it was like that with Darius. He couldn't sleep, so he's up at the crack of the dawn to see what has happened to Daniel. And what do you think? He receives a cheery good morning from the fellow. The fellow he expected to be reduced to a few bare bones amongst the lion's feet. So the God of the Jews is in the ascendant again, before a third king of the greatest empire on earth. You see what God's doing? He's exalting himself through his believing servants. Come right up to date. Who's the nearest to Daniel in our century? Niemöller, or Bonhoeffer, Solzhenitsyn, Georgi Vins, Watchman Nee? Who do you think? Have I not mentioned your one? Then King Darius wrote, Daniel 6, 25 to 28. See what he wrote. "But the interpreter of other people's dreams by revelation of God Daniel has his own dreams. Chapter 7 to the end. And they occupy the second half of this amazing prophecy. Let's run over them in a sentence or two each. Chapter 7 reveals the same four kingdoms, as I believe with Gurney. Babylon, the Medes, the Persians, the Greeks, with 10 kings issuing from the Greek kingdom of Alexander the Great. On the Syrian division of this great Greek kingdom after the death of Alexander the Great, culminating in the horrid Antiochus Epiphanes, on whose destruction the Jews under the Maccabees, Judas Maccabeus, regained Jewish freedom, which survived more or less despite Roman incursion, until the Ancient of Days sent the Son of Man to triumph by his cross. I've lost the beginning of that sentence, it doesn't matter. The visions, you see, of chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, in different ways and under different figures and in different extensions, reveal the future course of history as far as the Persians and the Medians and the Greeks, I've got them the wrong way around, the Medians and the Persians and the Greeks are concerned. That's what you have from 7 to the end, whatever the details may be. God is letting us see through Daniel and partly through Nebuchadnezzar in a curious way, because his was the first one. His dream was the first revelation. Oh yes, Nebuchadnezzar's dream was the first revelation. God's letting us see through all these dreams what he's going to do from then, the 6th century, until the coming of Christ, and right through to the second coming of Christ. Isn't it exciting? You don't need to be able to tie up every detail in a book like Daniel to see the marvel of the book, you see. Not at all. But where am I in my text? The Greek Empire with its divisions, you see, into Syria in the north and Egypt in the south until Christ appears. Notwithstanding, I would say, the great lumbering shadow of Rome, which some think has little real place in Daniel's prophecy, probably because even Rome couldn't prevent Christ's coming. Who could? What could? Nothing. The 12th chapter of Daniel undoubtedly sees through Christ's first coming to his second, with the general resurrection. And the limits of what the Spirit of God revealed to Daniel. For there were limits to what God revealed to Daniel, as there are limits to what God reveals to every man, even the Apostle Paul. There comes a time when God says, shut the book, that's enough. That's all you get to know. And if you spend your time trying to get to know what I don't want you to know, you're sinning. Accept your limitations, you see. So you have that in chapter 12. Not much wonder, though, that what Daniel saw in chapter 7 greatly alarmed him. Verse 28. And though he was frightened and fell on his face in chapter 8, do you see that? And was driven to sackcloth and ashes and fasting with supplications in chapter 9. And that awful personality-shaking trauma that he had in chapter 10. If we had time, we could read chapter 10. Look at verses 2 and 3. Look at verses 7 to 12. There, what Daniel went through. Whereas, in that massive chapter 11, there is considerable angelic support. You see, in chapter 10, he's in a dreadful state. But the angels came and supported him in that 11th chapter. So I'm saying in all this, and running through it at a disgraceful rate, here is a man who, as far as we can see from first to last, even in Cyrus's day, when the Jews came back to Jerusalem, but there's no sign of Daniel, now an old man coming back. Some claim that there's a grave of Daniel in Susa or Shushan. Is that Isfahan, Malcolm? Is it? Further south. But it's near it anyway, not very far from it. Well, they say that there's a grave of Daniel's in Susa, or Shushan. But what I'm saying is, here's a man who, as far as we can see, from first to last, is as transparent as purest crystal. Here was a son of the royal house of Judah, obviously handsome, gifted, able, influential among his peers and his betters, everything that could commend a young, personable fellow, with every advantage such a fellow could have had. And although a captive, yet he is really a captive son of the God of heaven and earth, who even in these dreadful things that had befallen Jewry was working out, God was working out a great purpose, which made it of all things an advantage for Daniel to be influential with the greatest king on the earth in that day. And yet, put yourself in his position. Right-hand man to Brezhnev or somebody like that. Come on, put yourself in such a position. And yet, because of his submission to his God, he laid all his natural advantages and all his honors before the Lord and was prepared to have no will but the Lord's and simply be an extension of God's will, like a mere obedient arm or foot or eye or ear. Every possibility, even the advantage of being next to the great Babylonian emperor himself, was to Daniel as absolutely nothing. It was dung and rubbish compared with this, that he might be of service to his God and to his king. To him to live was God, and to die, if need be, was gain. And I know, of course, in hurrying through Daniel, one might have taken it in two sweeps, two Sunday mornings. But I know that there are many fascinating facets of this extraordinary man's character that we could have discussed with profit today, from the racial and the cultural and the religious and the psychological and the sociological points of view. But even if we'd taken 2 weeks or a month or longer, one of these only interests me. And so I can bring what I'm trying to say down to the finest point that everyone will understand. Because I believe this particular point to be paramount and regulative of all the rest of this man's life. Daniel had learned how the Spirit of God must have wrought in his heart. Think of these choice men of the Jews in these darkest days. How wonderfully God wrought in the hearts of these men in Jewry's darkest days. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Zerubbabel, of the royal...